case of the day, appeal number 063917, United States versus Lawrence Legas. Ms. Legas.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Counsel. The District Court made a series of errors, beginning with repeated grants of extensions of time to serve process, despite no showing of government service attempts. It later erred in finding personal jurisdiction after dismissing the case for failure to serve. And then the District Court erred in refusing to allow Mr. Legas to conduct meaningful discovery. The threshold issue in this case to have proceeded in the District Court was to find personal jurisdiction. The District Court bent over backward in favor of the government to find personal jurisdiction. The case should have been dismissed.
What's wrong with that if there's evidence that someone is ducking service?
Your Honor, there is no evidence that there was any attempt to duck service. In fact, the District Court later found that the government could have served Mr. Legas with relative ease. That was Judge Holderman's words.
There's no evidence of attempting to duck service here?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the government never provided any record of service attempts before applying for extensions of time. The court never required the government to document any service attempts. And in fact, the government could not document any service attempts for 11 months after filing its complaint. The case should have been dismissed on September 3, 2004, after the first 90-day extension, because the government could demonstrate no cause for its failure to serve, and it could demonstrate no attempts to serve. Furthermore, the District Court had warned the government with its first extension of time that he would not grant any further extensions. Rule 4M provides the District Court with the discretion to grant an extension of time with or without good cause within a specified time frame. Rule 4M does not contemplate repeat extensions of time. And if a plaintiff fails to meet the new deadline, then Rule 6B may govern, which requires a showing for further extension. The District Court could not have found cause because it never required the government to show any proof of service attempts prior to granting extensions. And in fact, it took until May 17, 2005, more than 15 months after the government filed its complaint, for the District Court to dismiss the claim for failure to serve process. And the District Court was forced to admit that the government could have served with ease. In granting extension after extension, the District Court did not treat the government as it treated other plaintiffs, as demonstrated by Judge Holderman's actual dismissal of other cases for failure to serve during the same time frame, when it gave warnings to plaintiffs that no further extensions would be granted. As a rationale for repeated extensions, the District Court had relied on erroneous statements by the government's attorney in support of its request for extensions, such as the government's claims that it was impossible to serve Mr. Legas, and the District Court failed to make proper inquiry of the government's purported attempts. The District Court later admitted that the government had no just cause, that Mr. Legas had not evaded service, and that the government failed to exercise reasonable diligence in its responsibility to serve. Pursuant to Cooter and Gell versus Hartmarks, the Supreme Court has held that a court of appeals is justified in concluding that a district court has abused its discretion in making a clearly erroneous factual finding. Furthermore, in Riviera versus City of Chicago, this court held that failure of the district court to make proper inquiry is an abuse of discretion.
If I could just get the procedural chronology down here. There were, over the course of in excess of a year, as I understand it, was it three or four extensions of time?
Your Honor, there were four extensions.
Four extensions of time, and each one purported to be the last, as I understand.
That is correct. Judge Holderman used language in his orders, no further extension will be granted. The second time he said this is a final extension, yet he continued to grant extensions.
And then the last extension was actually then rescinded by the district court after the court learned that successful service had been achieved by the bank, which had been brought in.
Correct. The bank.
So then the district court rescinded the final extension and dismissed the case for lack of service.
Correct.
Lack of personal jurisdiction, but then reinstated it after your client asked to have the tax liens quashed.
That is correct.
Construing that as some sort of an agreement to jurisdiction, except by that point the statute of limitations had long since run?
Your Honor, the statute of limitations actually ran in less than a week after the complaint was initially filed. The statute of limitations ran in early February of 2004.
So what's the import of that once the case is dismissed?
In effect, it would have been a dismissal with prejudice. The issue with respect to the tax liens, Your Honor, was when the United States filed its request for a second extension of time after Judge Holderman had said there would be no further extensions. The United States also filed an amended complaint, which raised a foreclosure claim, and at that point named Lay Bank as a co-defendant. Lay Bank was the mortgage holder. Lay Bank, at that point, when it entered the case, filed to foreclose for breach of the mortgage. And so Mr. Legas was concurrently facing a foreclosure suit by Lay Bank, and the government's tax liens prevented any refinancing of the property to satisfy Lay Bank. Without removal of the tax liens, it was impossible to refinance the property.
Well, and the quashing of the tax liens had been requested in earlier...
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. Mr. Legas had made all his filings as a protest to personal jurisdiction, including the filing that requested removal of the liens. It went no further than previous filings. In previous filings, Mr. Legas had requested that the court dismiss the government's claim and release the liens as well. And the government had not previously objected to that and had not previously claimed that Mr. Legas was voluntarily entering the case when he said that. Without release of the liens, the court's dismissal order had no effect whatsoever for Mr. Legas. If we can kind of go back, if the court had dismissed the case after the first extension of time, as the court had warned the government it would do, then the case would have been dismissed before Lay Bank had even filed a foreclosure claim, and thus the issue of the tax liens would not be as pressing with the need to refinance Lay Bank's mortgage.
Do you know if there's any authority for reinstating a case that has been dismissed on personal jurisdiction grounds after the statute of limitations has run?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I also, the United States has claimed that, and the court has found that Mr. Legas waived his personal jurisdiction and voluntarily entered the case by requesting that the liens be dismissed. However, it was reasonable for Mr. Legas to expect the termination of the liens when the government had admitted in filings that the statute of limitations had expired and the liens would be legally unenforceable anyway. The government position on that was that Mr. Legas should have either waited for the government to release the liens in its own time or he could have sued the government for release of liens. However, that would not have resolved the issue of the foreclosure action that was pending with respect to Lay Bank. There was no case that I could find that was analogous to this. However, if it would give the court some clarity, in Bayou Steel, the Fifth Circuit has held that the federal rules abrogate the longstanding waiver rule by permitting a defendant to seek affirmative relief without forfeiting an objection to jurisdiction. Furthermore, the Federal Circuit in Rates Technology addressed the issue of a defendant filing permissive counterclaims after it had previously objected to personal jurisdiction, and the court held that the filing of a counterclaim cannot waive a party's objection to personal jurisdiction. And because Mr. Legas continually objected to personal jurisdiction, this was not waived. The third error that the court committed was the granting of summary judgment despite questions of material fact. The government relied heavily on documents prepared by the IRS during the course of litigation, a Form 4340, to prove a tax assessment had been made. Mr. Legas demonstrated a series of errors made by the IRS, including admissions that they had made mistakes with respect to this matter and that they had submitted incomplete transcripts. However, the court granted summary judgment in the government's favor anyway, despite these questions of material fact. Thank you.
Gregory.
May it please the court, I'm Karen Gregory representing the United States of America. I just want to first clarify one point on the statute of limitations. There were two assessments, or two groups of assessments, I should say, involved here. One involved Mr. Legas's individual income tax liability. The other involved what we call a Section 6672 penalty, or a responsible officer penalty, which had to do with the failure to pay over taxes that were withheld from his employees' salaries.
Both had expired at the time the suit was dismissed, though?
At the time of dismissal, yes, but not as of the time the bank was added to the suit.
But at the time of the dismissal, the statute of limitations had run. There's no question about that.
Right.
And what authority is there for reinstating a suit after dismissal once the statute of limitations has run?
Well, it's the procedural posture in this case really drives the outcome. And
is there any authority for that proposition? That the suit can be reinstated after the statute of limitations has run?
Well, the statute of limitations is told. I don't know of a case on point, but if I may explain how this would work. The statute of limitations for collection is told upon filing of a suit to reduce assessments to judgment. When the suit was dismissed, the time period for filing post-judgment motions had not run yet. The government could have appealed. If we're successful on appeal, then the statute of limitations issue becomes moot. So in the situation here where Mr. League has appeared solely to contest service of process and prevailed on that basis, and the suit was dismissed, he was not a party to litigation at that point. But he came back to the court and asked for affirmative relief that the court expressly said it had not reached because it was only ruling on the service of process issue. So the motion by which the court found the waiver of the jurisdictional defense happened after the case had been dismissed. So it's different between raising an alternative argument at the same time as challenging jurisdiction. Once the case was over, Legas returned as a plaintiff, and that's why the court allowed the case to proceed.
The validity of the tax liens depended upon the government's success in the lawsuit. And once the suit was dismissed, the quashing of the tax liens should have just followed as a matter of course.
Arguably.
Right? Because the tax liens depended upon the suit succeeding, and once it failed for lack of personal jurisdiction, that's the end of the tax liens. He should not have had to even come back in and ask that they be quashed. That should have just flowed as a natural outcome of the dismissal of the suit.
If that is what had happened, but the same day that the complaint was dismissed, Legas came back to court asking for relief. There's a provision in the Internal Revenue Code that requires the IRS to release a notice of tax lien when the liability has been paid or becomes unenforceable. Had Legas gone to the IRS and followed those procedures, that procedure would have been followed. But in the meantime, the government could still appeal the decision dismissing the complaint. This court held in McLaughlin that Rule 4 is not jurisdictional. So had the government appealed and prevailed, then the statute would not have run. The statute was still told until the government had exhausted its appeal rights.
I'm curious about whether the statute of limitations had run or not is particularly important here. The judge enters a dismissal order and later vacates the dismissal order. What difference does it make I realize it makes a difference to the defendant, but as a practical matter for our analysis of it, why does that make any difference? Judges vacate dismissal orders with some regularity, don't they?
Yes, and I agree with you.
I granted this dismissal in error, so I reinstate the case.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I just raised it to correct the factual misstatement in terms of the dates and bringing in late bank. I agree that it's irrelevant. Also, the repeated extensions of time granted by the district court are irrelevant because Legas have ultimately prevailed on that basis, and it wouldn't change the outcome at this point if those were reversed. The key issue is demanding affirmative relief for a basis other than improper service of process.
The government, are you waiving or have you argued that after the initial unsuccessful attempts to serve, there was a service attempted through FedEx or something like that, and it was received, that would have, combined with publication later in the Chicago Law Bulletin, wouldn't satisfy service by publication. I haven't seen that you've advanced that argument at all.
The service of publication was quashed because one piece of the procedure had been followed. The government below did not seek to republish at that point. It continued its attempts at personal service. The record does show that there were attempts at evasion here. The government notes in its brief that even the bank had difficulty serving Legas initially because he was hiding in his house. When the IRS agents went to serve, no one would answer the door, even though they saw people going into the house. So, but ultimately, Legas was served in a manner that complied with state law. The district court quashed that service, which has a legal consequence, but it doesn't change the fact that he was, in fact, served, which satisfies due process. He received a copy of the complaint. He had received multiple copies. He received it early on, voluntarily submit to the court's jurisdiction, which is why the government had to keep trying and trying to serve him. The fact that there were some errors, perhaps, in trying to serve is irrelevant with respect to the Form 4340s that the government submitted, which showed that he owed this tax. There's no question that he owed this tax. It was based on returns that he filed. It didn't show that he had paid it or that there was no rational basis for that assessment. And in that case, this court has held it's not going to go behind the government's Form 4340s to inquire about the government's procedures.
What happens if an employer does not pay to the IRS the taxes from an employee, and later that employee files a tax return and obviously wants a set-off of his liability by his withholding? Is that employee still given the credit, even though the employer might have, taken off with the money?
Right, and that is the basis for this Section 6672 penalty, because the employee gets credit whether or not the government got the money. So this way, to recoup that money, the government can go beyond the corporation and go to the responsible officers. Mr. Legas also presented no defense whatsoever to rebut the government showing that he was liable for that penalty for the years in issue. So, the service of process issue is not jurisdictional. Therefore, it doesn't tie into the statute of limitations issue. Basically, this case is, in all material respects, on point with McLaughlin, where this court held that it's not going to overturn a judgment that would result in a windfall to the taxpayer, which is what would happen here. And in that case, the court also said that the district court can grant extensions for any reason whatsoever under Rule 4.
Well, it's really a little different than McLaughlin, though. In McLaughlin, service was eventually obtained, and that's not the case here because the district court quashed the sort of end-game service that was achieved after 400 days or whatever it was. And the court, while it reinstated the lawsuit, did so not on the basis of that service, so it didn't recognize that service as valid. It reinstated the lawsuit based on this motion to quash, which the court viewed as a waiver of the personal jurisdiction defense, which had been asserted vigorously all along. So this is different procedurally than McLaughlin.
It's different procedurally in McLaughlin, but ultimately you have, in the government's view, Legas was served under state law. That service was quashed doesn't change the fact that due process was satisfied and that he received service. So we have a situation where service was accomplished, although later quashed. And
well, we have to accept that, right?
Right.
We have to accept the district court's quashing of the service and evaluate his alternative basis for jurisdiction here, which is that it was waived.
Right. My time is up, Meg.
Go ahead.
And the decision that it was waived is a correct one and should be affirmed. Thank you.
Your Honor is correct in stating that the district court did not acknowledge any service. It says, in fact, I have a transcript that I'm reading from. It says, this is Judge Holderman, it took forever too well. Actually, Mr. Snowenboss failed to properly serve the defendant, and that took forever, but that's history now. There was no service.
What was the lapse of time between the motion to quash, which I think was on May 17th, and the district court's ultimate ruling on the reinstating of the lawsuit?
It was from May 17th to July 8th.
Okay, so more than whatever the week was that was left on the statute of limitations.
Your Honor, the statute of limitations had told, on one lien claim, the statute of limitations told after only 3 days of filing the complaint. On the second one, it was a matter of a couple of months. With respect to the summary judgment, the 4340 forms that the IRS relies upon is a rebuttable presumption, and Mr. Ligas did rebut the presumption and should have been entitled to trial. He showed a series of errors made by the IRS employees. He showed that IRS employees had admitted mistakes in this case. With respect to the voluntarily entering the case, the government has vigorously claimed the government has claimed that he returned as a plaintiff, which is not correct in this case. And in fact, if he was no longer a party to the litigation because the case had been dismissed by the district court, the court should have just denied the request. Mr. Ligas had asked the district court, I see my time is up, may I finish my statement? Mr. Ligas had asked the district court to release the liens with his motion to reconsider the court's final grant of an extension of time, and the court did not address this. It took the IRS 13 years to file the complaint originally, and Mr. Ligas did not have 13 years to wait for the IRS to release the liens. Thank you, Your Honors.
Case to be taken under advisement. We will be in recess.